Good afternoon, and welcome to the Entheogenic Midwife podcast. This is Omalewa, your host. And today we have a special guest. We have Miss Britta Love, or B Love. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, and thank you for having me.
Yes. Well, we didn't formally meet, but I met Britta at the Empyrean Conference a couple weekends ago in D.C. And I just noticed how beautiful she was. Do you remember me saying, "You're so beautiful"?
I do. You were, and you gave such a wonderful presentation. Really enjoyable. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I just noticed your lipstick, the dress you wore, like you just stood out. So I just had to say something. So, you know, after the conference, everyone's adding everybody on Facebook, and I saw your profile and clicked on it. I said, whoa, I knew there was something special about you. So welcome, and thank you for joining us. So if you could tell us who you are, what you do.
Sure. So I'm based in Brooklyn, New York, and I do many things. I manage a space here in Brooklyn, but really my passions are I'm a writer and speaker on issues around sexuality and psychedelics and entheogens, and kind of consciousness and trying to bring a sociopolitical dimension to these topics as well, which is so often missing and feels so important for the healing of the world. And I also do some of my own healing work and consulting with people on entheogenic work. I'm also a somatic sex educator, which is a sort of hands-on modality for helping people to better connect to their bodies and their pleasures.
Awesome. Now, is that with and without psychedelics?
That's without. I always feel like there's sort of these parallels in my experience and in my own healing journey between the altered states that you can reach through conscious sexual practices and the altered states you can reach through entheogenic practices. So, and they kind of really were kind of interwoven in my healing journey, and it's not because I was so much doing them at the same time, but it was sort of like I would have an experience with a certain plant medicine, and then as I would notice I could kind of go deeper into embodiment and pleasure and kind of reach these different altered states through sex. It was almost like a integration practice. And I also did a lot of healing around the way that patriarchy and sexual trauma had been in my life. And so those things feel very connected for me, and I'm actually finalizing a draft of a book that sort of shares a bit of my story as a sex worker who came into conscious sexuality through my work, and as a former addict who came to psychedelics through needing to heal the roots of that addiction, and sort of the ways that both those things feel so important. So my book is going to be called The Poison is the Medicine, How Sex and Drugs Saved My Life and Save the World. So there are two very important passions of mine. And I think that, you know, and there, people are always like, oh, sex and drugs, like at the same time. And I think you can have really incredible experiences layering altered states. I tend to keep them separate in the, as a practitioner, because we have so much trouble just defining good ethics and consent and navigating these different states in our culture as it is. But I think that as the culture evolves, we might find ways to use them more synchronously as well.
Absolutely. Are you currently a sex worker?
So I do still consider myself a sex worker. I'm not doing straightforward escorting work at the moment, but I my somatic sex education practice, when we get trained, all the teachers are sex workers and have had other experiences with sex work and are very strong about the fact that we're still sex workers and not trying to like separate out certain kinds of sex workers because, oh, now we're healers. And I think all sex workers are healers, actually, if we choose to be, if we want to be. So I'm a big sex workers' rights advocate as well. And that, and really my experience was one of coming to sex work out of a lot of pain and dysfunction, of like sort of feeling very angry at men, feeling very disembodied, and as if my sexuality had so long never been my own since I was a teenager being harassed on the subways of New York City, that I kind of felt like, well, fuck it then. I'm going to charge them if they're going to use me like that. And so I came to it from a really angry and hurt place. And what was so interesting was that as I started working, I started really understanding patriarchy and toxic masculinity so much better because I saw men so much more in their vulnerability and the way that they were suffering under patriarchy as well, even if they're not always conscious of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really started to like feel like, oh, this is this healing role because sex workers are often some of the few people that a lot of cis men can feel like they can even come to and kind of be vulnerable and share about their lives and get really completely naked in that way. And so I started kind of seeing it as like a listening profession and kind of a healing profession. And then as I started coming more into my own embodiment and rediscovering pleasure in my body for the first time since I was a child, before I was kind of sexualized in not nice ways by our culture, as I reconnected back to that, I started finding more and more ways to bring that embodiment to my work. And sort of started advertising in ways that started attracting more clients who were maybe not looking for healing in a conscious way, but were attracted to the fact that I was offering something genuine and different, and really wanted to find something connected and really wanted to see this as sacred, to see that two strangers could meet and within the space of a few hours find the divine. And that became a strong passion and calling for me. And eventually I learned about sexological body work and somatic sex education. And that was really stunning to me because one of my regrets was I was always primarily working with men. I've had a few female clients, but I really wanted to bring more of the sexual healing work to women and folks of other genders as well. And also to create safe containers for people who really were coming in with a lot of trauma, who didn't necessarily want to just walk into a hotel room and have an interaction, but who really needed to sort of be guided through a journey of finding their choice and their voice and their agency again for the first time in a long time. And that modality, really, that's what that's about. It's about before we do any touch, we're really working to embody consent and figure out where the person is and make sure that everything is client-led. It's not like about my agenda as a healer. It's really about their own journey with their body. And I'm just sort of there as a pair of helping hands and a spirit to hold space.
Wow. Wow. So when you talk about somatic, could you explain a little bit more what that means?
Sure. So somatic, I don't know the exact etymology, but it's basically of the body. So a lot of times people are starting to have more somatic healing modalities, such as like even going to psychotherapy. There are now somatic therapists who will kind of guide you through talk, but while you're checking in with what you're actually feeling in your body. So you might have an emotion come up. Let's say you're feeling some anxiety talking about your mother, and they might go, so what are you noticing in your body right now? And you might say, oh, I'm feeling this knot in my stomach. And okay, let's see what happens if we breathe into that knot and just do this certain kind of breath work for a minute and see how it moves or shifts, or does it have a color? It's really about and there are a lot of other somatic modalities like mine that aren't talk therapy based, but it's basically a lot of healing work. I think people are starting to really understand that you can't just work through talking about it, that these memories live in the cellular, you know, in our cells, in their cellular memory, and they're really deeply embodied, and that real shifts need to come through working with what's living in the body. And so I am really grateful for the time that I spent in talk therapy and other modalities, but now I really wouldn't waste my time almost like on something that didn't have a basis in the body, because I think it's like a part of our kind of very Judeo-Christian, Western, like white supremacist sort of colonial thing to even approach the mind as separate from the body, as if they're not all one thing.
Absolutely. With me being a massage therapist, I noticed that a lot of people tend to have emotional releases As well as like an argument or just a bad memory or trauma tends to come out during those sessions. Would that be considered somatic work?
You know, it is. I think it's, you know, when we're doing body work and massage, it's absolutely a somatic healing practice. And I think that there, and a lot of the time when I'm doing somatic sex education work, we might just be doing work on like scar tissue release that won't be about like trying to necessarily bring pleasure, but just to like bring some loving attention to a part of the body where there's like, you know, the fascia are really knotted. And so like there's a lot of overlap with other forms of body work where and like similarly I'll notice that, wow, okay, I'm kind of palpating this one spot and suddenly this person who had experienced like childhood sexual trauma is feeling the as if someone's throttling their neck because that was what was happening to them at that age. And that memory will come up in this very embodied way, and then the person will have like an emotional release, and it will move, it'll shift. So it's so important. And I think that once I think that it would be a better world if all body workers had what kind of you have as someone who's also working with like, you know, like spirit and healing generally, to have that lens so that we can better hold those experiences when they come up. Because otherwise, you can kind of go for a massage and not understand why you're suddenly crying. And if the person doesn't know how to kind of handle that, it can be awkward. But actually, that's what kind of should happen or can happen, is that those experiences can be so opening for so much emotional and spiritual healing.
Absolutely. I actually incorporate that into my psychedelic practice, massage therapy and spiritual bathing.
Oh,
'Cause
beautiful.
those are two components that I feel, again, like birth, like helps just to move things around and start the process of healing. And again, those traumas and memories get stuck into the muscles, the tissue, the cells, the blood, you know. So it's like an added therapy that I feel is needed when you're going to bring those things up.
Absolutely. And that's like just another way that I think, because so often we're looking at psychedelics being mainstreamed in this like very limited psychiatric model, they're missing a lot of the embodiment pieces. So I'm always so grateful when I get to connect with other practitioners who have this embodied knowledge and are bringing it to their practices, because I think the psychiatrists and therapists can have a lot to learn from some of these other ways we already know how to work with for healing, and ways that go back to indigenous practices all over the world as well.
Absolutely. I was looking through your page and I saw you on the on a panel for Horizon with the psychedologist Leah Freeman. Such a sweetie. I love her.
Lovely. She's
Yeah.
the best.
Could you talk about sexual ethics in the psychedelic community?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting because I sort of came to this. I've only come to doing this work around sort of Me Too and embodied consent and like really having spaces for talking about sexual harm in the last couple of years, because I kept encountering it in various communities, but here specifically in the psychedelic community, you know, with people going to see ayahuasqueros or traditional shamans or underground therapists and having abusive or harmful experiences. And I realized that I was always talking about, you know, conscious sexual practice as this kind of like healing and opening and spiritual journey, but that so many people are going to see healers and being re-traumatized or traumatized for the first time, because we don't have a culture. We have such a sexually dysfunctional culture that people's shadows are coming out as healers so often, and as leaders in the community. You know, I've known people who work for community organizations or conferences to, you know, for those kind of things to happen as well, where there's predatory behavior. So I got invited, because I do work around sexuality, to participate in a transformative justice process around someone who had committed sexual harm. And that experience blew my mind, because I started learning. I mean, the experience itself felt like being in a medicine circle. You know, there was no psychedelics involved, but it was like passing a talking stick and being in community and really trying to hold this person with loving intention, because they were willing to take accountability, to bring them on a journey to like deal with how, you know, hurt people hurt people. How do they get to the place of hurting people, and how do we support them moving to a place where they won't be doing that again? As well as a concurrent process around helping the people who are harmed and the survivors, which is a separate work, which is equally, if not more important too. But so that kind of got me on this journey, and a lot of these conversations that I started having with other people who were involved in that process or who'd experienced sexual harm in other contexts in the community made me realize, like, this is something that I really want to devote my energy to. As a somatic sex educator, we get a lot of training in consent and embodied consent, because sometimes consent we think of as like, oh, did she say yes or did she say no? And we don't really understand that a lot of us are, especially when we've been socialized as women, but in general in our culture, we're socialized to not always check in with our bodies before we kind of go along with something, that we kind of like appease or fawn or just go into the response of like responding to a person's expectations. So how do we even learn how to feel what we want and then trust that little feeling and honor it enough to then have the courage to vocalize it? Like, that's a whole other section of how we develop communities that are sexually ethical, is that, you know, a lot of us have work to do on our being in consent with ourselves. A lot of the time we go to the doctor and the doctor just does things to us, so we have this model of going to a healer and whatever they want to do is just what we're gonna go along with, and so we have to interrupt a lot of these dysfunctional dynamics. So my presentation as part of that Horizons Conference Day to Address Sexual Harm is trying to sort of dream, like, what could a really conscious psychedelic Me Too look like? And that is going to involve some workshop pieces on finding embodied consent. It's going to be a little bit of workshop and presentation on, like, power dynamics, which is something we don't talk about very much, but, you know, like a doctor and a patient, or a healer and a participant, or a public speaker and a workshop attendee. Like, these are all power dynamics, and if we suddenly step into positions of power and haven't been thoughtful about it, we might inadvertently cause harm because we don't realize that the person's looking to us or feels in response to us in some way, you know, lower down, like there's a hierarchy happening. So, and that really affects consent. And then also, what do we do when people harm people? Because it sucks to have to just constantly blacklist people and cancel them. And unfortunately, when we do that, we pass them on to the next, you know, downstream community that's going to have to deal with their behavior as well. So what can we do to transform that if the person's willing to be accountable about their behavior when they're called out? So that's kind of the topics that have been really big on my mind. And I'm going to be presenting on that alongside Laura Northrup, who is an amazing somatic therapist based out in the Bay Area, who's going to be talking about, well, some of the dynamics, the psychodynamics that happen between practitioners and clients and therapists and their patients that lead to sexual harm. Leah Friedman is going to be facilitating an integration circle and community dialogue around these topics. And we're bringing in two amazing restorative justice facilitators who are going to be, that's going to be the biggest chunk of the day, just facilitating a conversation in the style that we would bring any challenge in restorative or transformative justice, of like sitting in a circle and passing a talking stick and everyone gets their time, so that we can really come together as a community and talk about what people's experiences are, what their feelings are, what their needs are, what we can do to start really addressing this better in our community. So I'm really excited, because I don't think there's really been a space created for these conversations in the psychedelic community before, or at least not on this scale. It's just going to be the first step. And I think we're going to be hoping to do a bigger and more extensive like training and workshop next year. But we really felt it was important to, and luckily Horizons did too, and are sponsoring it, which we're really grateful for, to make a place for this to be addressed, because otherwise it feels like it's just going to keep happening over and over again.
Wow. I can be a little green, but I had been getting calls about, you know, sexually unethical practices that are going on in communities. And I guess there's that part of me that believes so strongly, and I work with psilocybin specifically, but it's like I thought it was just healing and getting people out of their ego, and people are seeing their God self, their higher selves. So when I heard these things going on and women getting abused and manipulated and homeless and babies, and even in like Peru, women waking up and their panties are gone and there's blood and they've been robbed. I was like, what the hell? This is another layer that I didn't even realize existed. And it hurts, you know?
It really does. It was such a rude awakening for me as well, because I feel like I similarly had this like very like idealistic, like joyful like feeling for a few years when I first started doing this work and being in these communities of like, this is the future, we're doing it, like everything's great, the medicines are the teachers, and this is just going to lead to a better world. And then when you start seeing our shadow emerge even in those spaces, it's so disheartening and heartbreaking. And so there's been, for me, I kind of had to start trying to understand it better, because I'm for all my training, I still go to trying to figure things out with my brain before my body. So I started really looking into like, what are the parallels? Why are these why is this happening in these healing spaces? And I actually, because I had an experience myself, I was my biggest healing came from, in terms of like, if I think of like this ceremony, there's a before the ceremony and an after the ceremony of Britta, was with Iboga, but when I was dealing with my addiction. And I ended up going to Gabon with a healer who I first worked with in Costa Rica, and going through a traditional Bwiti initiation. And while I was there, I witnessed this healer being predatory on one of the participants, and later got to speak to her about the trauma that had ensued, and started hearing lots of other stories of other people who had had that experience. So that was my big rude awakening. And I started to see that in our culture, we look to, the CEOs or the presidents or the, the people, those are the power positions. And in traditional cultures, the healer or the shaman's a power position, and it is a powerful position. You're holding someone vulnerably, and most people I think are attracted to that work because they've been wounded and then healed, and they want to pass on that gift. But unfortunately, like any other powerful profession, people who are attracted to power come into it. And I think that's something that I just, it hadn't occurred to me until I witnessed it, and then I started seeing that parallel, everywhere. Not just in Gabon, in South America, in America, with, and even our therapists and healers, like I think it's really interesting. There's this kind of racist, I would say, kind of hysteria that's going on around like ayahuasca and sexual violence. And I'm always telling people, you realize that in America, like our mental health professionals, in an anonymous survey on one of the only studies that's even been done on this, found that 7 to 12% of them self-reported, so it's obviously a lot higher, like incidences of sexual boundary, like erotic contact boundary violations with their clients. So this is already happening in what we think of as like, oh, I went to see my doctor or my therapist, my mental health professional. I think it's so global, and I'm just glad that people are, we're all starting to put the pieces together and come together in more ways to find ways to address it, because power is intoxicating, and we're not really taught how to operate with it. And so some of us, I think, intuitively have an instinct to like check in around our ethics and integrity and get into conversations with people about it, and have close people to us who will call us out if they see something out of order. And other people are not so interested in that, or it hasn't occurred to them, or they're, sociopathic and they don't care. So that's the culture that we have to build, is one where I think where people who are going to see a healer realize that's a possibility, and are looking out for any red flags, because so often we approach healers with this sort of like guru mentality that they're just going to be these perfect, amazing people, and we're all not that. So, but hopefully some of us are in more integrity with our shadows than others, So I guess coming together and having more of these conversations is going to help. But and also I think that a lot of the harm happens in ways that are unconscious and the people aren't necessarily sociopaths. But if you have a shadow related to rejection and never being able to access sexual pleasure or be, you know, be successful with women, for example, and you suddenly are a powerful person in the community, you might not realize that what you think is just you coming on to someone is actually them perceiving it as you hold their career or their healing in your hands. And that's not a choice that can be made of, you know, like with full consent, because there's that power dynamic, that there's other pieces in it. So we're trying to hopefully have start having conversations where we learn to identify those power dynamics and identify what it looks like when people are not operating in integrity with those.
Question. Do you find that the sexual abuse is more common with men against women?
It's a really good question. I've thought a lot about this because, you know, my, you know, statistically, yes, that's what we find is like statistically, while sexual violence happens by all genders, against all genders, we do find the majority as men against women. But I started unpacking that. I met this really brilliant friend of mine, Jennifer Patterson, at graduate school, and she was putting together an anthology. It was called Queering Sexual Violence. And her perspective really impacted like a big shift in my own, because it was really an anthology of people who had who were, you know, survivors of sexual harm that weren't the traditional narratives and were being left out a lot of the time from accessing services and conversation and support because they weren't, like, it wasn't the traditional, like, abusive man, victim woman kind of dynamic. And so I started reading, you know, some of that work and looking into it and started understanding more about power and how power was leading to harm, I realized that the statistic that it's more often men committing the harm made sense only because under patriarchy, men have more power systemically in every way. So I don't think it's that men are born more capable of harm. I think we're all born capable of harm and capable of doing amazing things. But I think that between the way that toxic masculinity does tend to sever men's connections to their emotions and to their selves and their sexuality in a holistic way, and the fact that then they're then also privileged in positions of power where it's much easier for them to abuse, we end up seeing it happen that way. But I no longer have that kind of idealism that if it was just all us women in power, this wouldn't happen, because I think it wouldn't happen right now because we've never experienced what it's like to have that kind of messed up hierarchical patriarchal structure. So part of what I try to talk about is what could it mean to create more non-hierarchical healing spaces? Because if we just try to slot women and other genders into the same power structures that men have had, like, it's the power structure that patriarchy, that's what defines it, you know, is that someone rules over someone else. Like, a lot of older societies were ruled more in circle. Everyone might have a specific skill or talent or thing they were known for, but everyone was equal and those talents were valued equally. Mm-hmm. And once you start creating those hierarchies, that's when you get these problems. And really, patriarchy is the creation of those hierarchies and unfortunately just putting men in them and no one else. But I don't think that just switching the gender is the answer, you know? That's kind of where I've come to on that, is really trying to figure out if, to me, the deepest antidote to patriarchy is undoing those power structures and empowering each of us to feel like equals in community, which I think is a much more typically feminine, in quotes, kind of way of approaching it. But sort of, I think good examples like putting Margaret Thatcher or Hillary Clinton in positions of power doesn't necessarily undo some of the toxic things that are happening, right?
Heck no.
So it's more about, to me, undoing those structures, creating better structures.
And I'm just, and I know this can be a very sensitive topic. It just leads me to think about how like so much psychedelic work and ayahuasca and certain things are becoming so trendy, and how sometimes people are just jumping right into it, you know, with their trauma, with their stuff, without maybe, like I say, even having a regular massage therapy routine. You know, or having certain spiritual and self-care practices to where the intuition and the discernment is a little bit more fine-tuned.
Yeah,
You
for
know,
sure.
so 'cause I can, you know, and things happen. Don't get me wrong, but I'm just curious about, you know, how that works. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we tend to present things in our culture in a very like one-dimensional or two-dimensional way. It's sort of saying that, you know, like drink this thing and you will be healed, and this is all good and this is all bad. And I think because that's how our mainstream kind of culture presents things, it does leave people really not well prepared for the complexity of finding a healer and deciding if they're ready and having the pieces in place to support them before and after. And so, you know, yeah, that's a big part of the problem is that, you know, I always think these things work really well in on the small community level, because on the community level, we've been doing that for thousands and thousands of years. We know how to check each other and, you know each other, trust each other. In a community, if someone misbehaves over and over again, everyone knows about it. No one's gonna let them get away with it. But once you start scaling this up and, you know, and commodifying it, and so is now advertising this retreat here, and you can go for $5,000, you can have this experience and we'll solve all your problems. There's no community accountability, and capitalism distorts that even more, because there's the profit motive that distorts the healing motive. So it gets really complicated and messy. And I think what I've been coming to, I've been inspired by like people like Adrienne Marie Brown, and who wrote Emergent Strategy and Pleasure Activism, and some of the stuff in Emergent Strategy talks about like really how we can make our movements for change mimic more how nature does things, because nature does things like so well and on such a grand scale, but not in this top-down kind of way of, well, now, you know, now this big magazine reported on ayahuasca and everyone's going to go do it. But if we could all have small pockets of, you know, communities all over the country that are holding these things with integrity and bringing people into them and guiding them through what they need to learn to be prepared for it and make the best, you know, make the most out of the experience, I think it's going to be so much more successful than everyone buying Michael Pollan's book and then going out to see who's selling a ceremony. You know, I think the community level is where we can kind of screen out a lot of these problems. And that means keeping up, I think, the work that's happening underground rather than looking to this kind of top-down implementation of legal medicine through certain channels without it being grounded in community. And I think that's also what the medicines are almost trying to teach us, I think, you know, is how to come back into those ways of being with each other.
Now, I feel like me being a healer in my community, I often feel overlooked, you know. So we're in this social media society where, well, outside of social media, I feel like there is no such thing as community or village anymore. If we're not living together and being immediately accountable for one another, day to day. So with that, it's like, you know, I may be talking about mushrooms and someone say, oh, well, I'm going to Peru and I'm going to do ayahuasca. You know, I don't knock people for what they do, but it's kind of like, you know, you're more susceptible. Like, I'm here in your community. I know you. I know your family. I care for you. I love you. I have your best interest in mind. You know, so I don't know. It's just like even like a rites of passage into the work. It's like when or the protocol that I recommend for people, it's kind of like there's some certain clearing and releasing and purification needs to take place before you even go into the medicine. So that's again what this podcast is for, just so people can start being more aware, like, oh wow, shamans are doing this. Yes, they are. You know, and we're kind of setting ourselves up. So I'm really hoping that we can get back to community and accountability, because this is serious when people are open in those vulnerable spaces. So it's just like birth. We've turned it
Of
over to
course,
men.
yeah.
And
Exactly.
I did the 920 psilocybin summit, and Daniel was asking about sacred space, and I mentioned at the conference, like, we are women, we have wombs, we are the original keepers of sacred space. You know, we used to birth the baby. So how did, you know, it just seems like there's more room for error when we start, I won't say introducing men. I'm not a male basher or a male hater, but it's just kind of like it
Well,
seems to leave more room for error.
they have more healing work to do to be able to come into this kind of work because of the way that patriarchy really cuts them off from such a young age, from the first time they're told not to cry, from the first time they're laughed at for being gay. I mean,
Well,
there's so many
from the circumcision.
from the yeah,
From
thank
the
you,
circumcision, you know?
exactly. It's like the most brutal initiation into toxic masculinity, like day three of your life or whatever it is. You know, it's really unbelievable that that's normalized in our culture. It's and I can't even imagine. Like, I don't think we'll ever be able to measure how deeply that's impacted our the some of the really toxic and harmful aspects of our culture
We
to have
see it. We
generations
see
of
it. We see it.
Yeah,
We feel
exactly.
it, those of us that are in tune. So it's kind of like they're on this search for the rest of their lives to get that little bit of power back that they lost. You know? Oh, I just got that. I don't know where that came from. Be love. But
That's magic.
seriously, yeah, it is. So it's kind of like with the medicine being this healing modality, it's kind of like they get to a certain point and they get stuck. Like, my favorite thing is the male ego is a hell of a drug. So it like it activates it even worse, but it's like, brother, keep going, keep going. You know, don't stop here, and now you're the guru of sacred plant medicine. It's like you just really tapped into your trauma. Keep going. So when, again, with social media, like, people are healers and gurus, all of a sudden it's like, wait a minute, you're only halfway through the journey.
And I think that like, to me, the healers that I like learn the most from and respect the most and model my work after are the people who know that our work is never finished for ourselves. We're always keeping on with the work, and that's our ability to keep going to those places and go deeper and stay mindful and conscious and connected to all parts of ourselves. Like, that's what makes a good healer. And the people who think, well, I had this healing experience and now I'm just, you know, gonna sit here and work on all of you, it doesn't, that's not how it works. You know, it's a very like that's a very like capitalist model as well. You know, take the pill, I'm cured, and now I can just go out in the world and do what I want.
Yeah. And that's why we as healers definitely have to connect more and create these bonds and relationships and alliances so that we can hold one another accountable, you know, and flash the light in those dark spaces that some of us still have, you know, healing circles and different things to make sure that we're free and clear and coming from a righteous space when we're serving others.
Which is, you know, and it's so hard too because we're all, you know, no matter how much healing work we do, we're living in this really toxic culture, and even just the way that we have to keep, you know, unlike in most traditional societies where the healers were always provided for by the community through gifts and through community support, we still have to pay our rent and, you know, and like having that stress of like having so the pressure of like do I have enough healing clients, or I'm working more this week than I should do, but actually like I need to earn money too. Like, those things can start to creep in and distort our work as healers too, and it's really hard because we're working within these systems of oppression that are so much bigger than ourselves. And I always get so nourished by connecting with other healers where we can process and talk about these things and have healing circles for ourselves, because who heals the healer is a really important question. And I think being in community is a big piece of that. And I one thing that was really like that I really learned from trying to do this transformative justice work around sexual harm is that it's modeled after like indigenous practices of talking circles. So there's like actually there's a beautiful documentary called Hollow Water, and it's about this indigenous town in Canada where they had such high rates of childhood sexual abuse that it wasn't even a matter of like getting a certain number of people arrested or taken away from their kids. It was just, it was an epidemic. And so the town realized they had to do something differently because they couldn't just take all the parents away. And they brought back the talking circle and they used that as the model to heal. So the kids were removed from their parents while this was going on. And over the course of several years, the documentary follows a few families. One of them was two parents, both of them had been abusing their kids separately. They hadn't even known about it. It was quite intense and emotional. And you watch them go on their healing journey and come to meet their shadow and the pain, because they'd both been abused as children as well. And as they come through this process, they're able to reintegrate with their kids. And you see the daughter sit there and say, you know, I never thought I'd be able to feel safe sitting alone on a couch with my dad in a room again. And like, I can see how he's changed and the work that he's done. I mean, this is the kind of healing that's so foreign in our culture to even like imagine is possible. And the reason it worked is because they were a community. There was a sense of accountability. They were interdependent and interreliant. And when I started trying to do this transformative justice work in the psychedelic community, I realized we call ourselves a community, but we see each other maybe at a conference or on social media, but we're not such thing. Community. Yeah. And that's the biggest like hindrance. That's the biggest like, you know, stumbling block to this actually working, is that we really need these interconnections. Because that's how nature works, through webs. Like we can't do it alone. So one person who I've learned a lot from, her name is Mia Mingus. She does work with the Bay Area Transformative Justice Collective. She talks about this idea of pod mapping. And the idea is that every person should have a few people in their head, and it might take a while to develop those connections, and you might find out you don't have as many people you could call on for this as you'd like, which was my experience, but then you start nurturing those relationships more, to sort of have like a handful of people that you know you can check in with when you're going through either a crisis where you need support or a time when you need to be held accountable. And to like reach out to that person and be like, hey, would you like to be accountability buddies? You know, and then practice holding each other accountable for really like basic things. Like, I need to be more hydrated. I have a hydration goal this week. Can you check in with me in a week and see how much water I've been drinking? You know, or, you know, whatever it's going to be. I have a writing deadline, or I'm going through this divorce and I really need someone to check in once a week with me while I'm going through it. You know, practice building community again with those small things. Well, divorce is not small, but the, you know, the hydration goal, the small things, so that when big things happen and we need to be held accountable or hold others accountable or support each other through really deep harm, we have those networks in place again, because they've been really destroyed by the way our culture keeps us so separated from each other.
Yeah.
And that's something that I'm just learning how to do again. It's like a muscle that's atrophied, you know?
Yeah.
It feels so important.
And I feel again with social media, it's creating this false illusion of what? Friends, groups, mm-hmm. circles, mm-hmm. you know? So it has us living in a state of illusion. That's why I feel eventually we're going to have to pull out, you know, yeah. and create these spaces. And then when you want to see these people, there's a bit of a rites of passage or a process where it's going to take to see if you're really going to do the work. I don't want to get lost in the shuffle of fake gurus and healers and just people who are talking about things and not actually executing. You know, even with the psychedelic work, I feel more people need to be growing and cultivating their own medicine. It comes with a whole nother connection and respect for the work, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a different thing when you can be in connection with the living being and have that reciprocal relationship, because that's the other thing is like, again, you know, like a broken record, like consumer capitalism, but it's like, you know, this idea that we're taking a medicine rather than in relationship with a medicine, you know, like what's the reciprocal part there. And I mean, that's something I'm always trying to figure out for myself with some medicines that I work with that don't grow here. But, you know, even just in terms of reciprocating with the people who've kept these medicine lineages, like if we're going to drink ayahuasca and, you know, we're kind of really shifting the cultural landscape down there by going down to another culture to have this spiritual tourism and then come back, like, and yet those the same indigenous people are being brutalized by, you know, the Brazilian president and the oil companies, and what are we giving back to sustain those plants and those people? And so finding a way to be more relational to the plants and the people who've supported these lineages feels like something that's so important and really missing from the psychedelic mainstreaming conversation as well.
Yes. Well, thank you so much. I know you have other things going on, so I want to give you time and space for that. If you want to tell us how to find you, as well as a little bit more about the Love Shack, a little place in Brooklyn.
Oh, absolutely. So, yeah, you can find me online on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, Britta Love on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. My handle is Britta Loved, like past tense with a D at the end.
Yes.
So BRITTALOVED. Or you can go to my website, which is now BrittaLoved.com. Same. And I also manage a space in Brooklyn we use for all sorts of private events and photo shoots. And we love having people come in for more conscious events and work as well. So that's called the Love Shack. And you can go to lovetheloveshack.com and see our kind of psychedelic fantasy Alice in Wonderland meets Marie Antoinette that my partner and I developed based on the medicine vision ourselves, and check out that space. And I just love being in conversation with people who are thinking about these things, because it is going to take all of us. And thank you so much for having me on, and I'm so grateful that we got to have this conversation.
Yes, I said I knew there was something special about you. Yes, thank you so much. And I look forward to staying in touch and even learning more about Iboga and your experience with that. So maybe we'll have you another time.
Oh, I would love that. Absolutely. Wonderful. Thank you so much. And we'll speak soon.
Yes. Take care. Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.